Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Congress. Tomorrow is Inauguration Day, so today's episode is the last installment of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I have been sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me to discuss what President-elect Joe Biden faces on Capitol Hill are Algene Sedgery and Chris Tuttle. Algene is the founder and CEO of Catalyst Global Strategies. From 2012 to 2020, she was senior foreign policy and national security advisor to Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. As Democratic policy director from 2015 to 2018, Algene was the first African-American woman to hold a senior leadership position on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. She previously held leadership roles in the House. Algene hosts her own podcast, The Minority Leaders, which highlights women of color changemakers in politics and policymaking. Chris is the managing director at the Council on Foreign Relations. From 2015 to 2019, he served as the policy director of the majority staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Previously, Chris was a director of CFR's Washington Program and Independent Task Force Program. Before joining the Council, he worked at the State Department and as chief of staff to then-Representative Mark Green of Wisconsin. Algene and Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
I want to begin by talking about the mood on Capitol Hill. This is clearly an unusual time for Congress and for the country. And we've had major developments so far this month. January 5th, we had the Georgia Senate runoff elections, which led to Democratic victories, meaning the Democrats will, as of tomorrow, control the Senate and control both houses of Congress. We also had on January 6th, the mob invade the Capitol, really sort of upending politics and changing discussion here in the United States. I will note that two-thirds of House Republicans and about a half dozen Senate Republicans still voted not to certify the votes from Arizona and Pennsylvania. So obviously there is a lot of division on Capitol Hill, but perhaps, Algene, you could start us off by giving us a little bit more context about what kind of Congress Joe Biden's going to face.
Thank you. And again, thank you for having me. It's always an honor to join Chris Tuttle and partner with him on anything. He is a dear friend and former colleague who I respect greatly. I think the mood on Capitol Hill is one where we're going to see a divided Senate. We're going to see a 50-50 split. And I think there's a sense that folks need to come together and figure out how to work going forward in a more conciliatory way. Obviously, there are certain folks that are going to hang on to the past, and there's certain folks that are going to want to see accountability, as I think is warranted for some of the events of late, especially January 5th and 6th. And I think, though, that there's a recognition that in order for Congress to function, they have to govern. And that means they have to work together. There's very few people in the middle anymore. I think Chris and I came up in a time where you had a lot of moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans that were really seen as, you know, the conscience of the Congress, right? And now we see some polarization. Each side is being pulled to the more extreme. But I think there's, after the 6th and those events, there's a sense that we really need to get past this and really need to figure out a way to talk with each other about common sense solutions that really impact the American people and reassure our allies that we are the leaders on democracy and we know how to govern and get things done in this country. So I think there's a real sense that we need to do better going forward.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, Algene, before I bring Chris in the conversation. Sure. Are you an optimist that that healing, that move toward unity can actually occur?
You know, in the past, I've always been an optimist, and I think I'm trying to stay optimistic. I think some real structural changes need to happen in the way that we fund elections, the way that we elect people to Congress, and even, you know, within the states at local levels, in order for that real healing and reconciliation to happen. I think a lot of reforms need to happen, but I am optimistic that there are a lot of good people on both sides who really want to see a change, I am optimistic that they'll be able to make it work. It's going to take some time. It's going to take a lot of healing. I think it's going to take both sides recognizing they're not going to get everything they want in order for that to happen. But I try to remain optimistic because at the end of the day, people realize that the American people really, despite what happened on the 6th, most of the American people want to see America move forward and don't want to see our country devolve into that. What we saw on the 6th was really something Chris and I have seen in the developing world and we have scorned, right? And the U.S. has scorned. And we don't want to devolve into that. We want to show the global community that we can do better than that. So I think there's enough good people there that really want to do the right thing. And hopefully we'll be working in concert with each other across party lines, across the chambers to get things done.
So Chris, give me your take on the current mood on Capitol Hill. Are you an optimist like Al Jean, or do you tend more to be pessimistic about where we're headed?
Well, I'll take the first question first, which is sort of the general mood on Capitol Hill. And I would say among the people I talk to on both sides, it's pretty dark. The riot really shook people up. And among Republicans in particular, there's sort of an attitude or a questioning. There's this, what are we doing here? You know, what have we kind of gotten involved in? This is compounded on the political side among Republicans by the loss of 2 Senate seats in Georgia, of all places. And I think there are serious questions about the future of the Republican Party. I think that there are some silver linings for staffers on both sides in that I think that a return to a more, for lack of a better term, normal administration makes it easier for Congress to do its job and do things like regular oversight hearings and getting back into sort of the regular routine of conducting oversight, to have an administration where it's very unlikely, I think, that they're going to do things that are sort of arcane but matter to staff and to members, like on arms sales. There's something called blowing through congressional notification where Congress actually has a say on arms sales. And you've seen the Trump administration sort of discard those things, as well as, you know, some of the emergency declarations that have come out of the administration, that kind of thing, that have really, you can say politically whether or not you agree with those ideologically, but in terms of Congress being able to be once again better able to assert itself as compared to the previous 4 years, I think there's a silver lining there. Among Republicans, there's also a silver lining, I think, in that with Trump sort of going away, there's an opportunity to sort of unite the party in a little bit better way when you have a foil like the Biden administration. This is tamped down some by the fact that, you know, there are probably going to be some policy losses, but I think that Capitol Hill is a political place. And so Republicans are thinking about the future and are thinking, how do we sort of rebuild right now? So I would say that the mood, at least among the people I talk to, is still pretty dark. I think it remains to be seen whether there's reason for optimism or pessimism.
I wanted to just comment on that. I think that the Republican Party mood is dark, obviously, because of the incidents that occurred and what it means for the Republican brand. And I think by thinking through ways that we can work together to get things done for the American people, when I say optimism, I'm thinking optimism that we can actually get some stuff done. And we're not going to be, hopefully, in a place where we're going to be supporting policies that drive us further apart. I think there's a lot of opportunity to work with the Biden administration to get common sense legislation through that really can impact Americans and their livelihoods and really set ourselves right on a better course. And so that's what I would say about that. I think that there's a great opportunity there.
Al Jean, I want to pick up on the opportunities for, we used to call bipartisanship, when the parties could come together on some things. Before we do that, there's one big issue that I think we need to talk about and I neglected to mention in my first question. Not only did you have the Georgia elections, not only did you have the riot and the mob attack on January 6th, you subsequently had the House of Representatives vote to impeach President Trump. And so I'm wondering, as we talk about how to bring people together, what role will impeachment play? Now, I understand that Speaker Pelosi, as of today, hasn't said when she will transmit the article of impeachment, so we don't know when a trial could formally begin. I assume one will happen eventually. But how does that play, Chris, into the talk about trying to bring the two sides together? Because clearly, even though 10 House Republicans voted for impeachment, including Liz Cheney, the number 3 ranking House Republican, the vast majority of House members didn't vote for impeachment. So how does that play into this equation?
Well, it plays in a couple ways. First, there's the obvious, which is an impeachment is going to be a divisive issue no matter what. And I don't think you're going to get 17 Republican votes for conviction of President Trump. The other thing is, you know, there's going to be a question as to whether or not, and it's still going back and forth on this, on how exactly they're going to divvy up the days, you know, and whether or not nominations are going to be able to move. You know, I mean, we're seeing some senior administration officials, incoming administration officials, having their hearings today. That's a little bit behind. You know, typically Congress would already be having hearings on things, you know, for nominees such as the Secretary of State. But that process is behind. So you have the prospect of if Congress does decide, or the Senate can decide that it is going to bifurcate the days, you're going to have a very strange dynamic where you've got to move nominees from the Biden administration in the morning and then go into an impeachment conversation each afternoon. So I think it's going to be pretty divisive, and it will have actual policy impact when it comes to when nominees are able to get into their positions. And these are senior level, you know, the most senior level people. We're talking about secretaries of state and defense. So those are a couple of sort of things to think about on that front.
Algie, let me ask you about it, because you've struck the note of the importance of trying to find common ground. I think it's safe to say that impeachment is divisive. I mean, I know Democrats are very angry at President Trump and think that Republicans should join them in condemning his behavior by voting to convict. But again, as Chris said, it's hard to see 17 Senate Republicans going that way. So how do you view it, the impeachment trial and its impact on the policy agenda, and also simply on the personnel agenda, as Chris just laid out?
Well, I think on the nominations front, I mean, we saw this before. There was a trial, and I was there when there was a trial, the first trial. We moved nominees in the morning and had the hearings in the afternoon, the proceedings in the afternoon. So we can, especially the Senate, can walk and chew gum at the same time. And I think that that's what's going to have to happen. We will see on Thursday two new senators from Georgia sworn in. The Democrats will have the ability to move their nominees. And I think that to the extent that folks want to get things done, and I think McConnell right now wants to get some things done and wants to see these nominees in place, because we're talking about the Secretary of State, also the Secretary of Defense, who's usually in from day one. We're talking about really senior leadership that we need to have, and everybody recognizes we need to have in place ASAP from day one so that we can start the business of governing, right? And so I think that there will be some negotiations, and those things are, you know, still being discussed, as Chris said, but at the end of the day, we'll see some movement. With the changes in how nominations are handled, you can delay, but not necessarily stop the administration, especially with this 50-50 split with Kamala Harris as the president of the Senate breaking any ties. They can't actually stop the nominees from going through. And so we're going to see those nominees go through. On the legislative agenda, there's a couple of other things that will have to happen. This is a budget reconciliation year. We're going to see some things go through that mechanism that would move faster than other priorities or in other contexts. And so we'll see that majority vote threshold really enable the administration to move certain things. And I think that the Biden administration will be looking for common ground. And they have also actually pledged to confer more readily and more easily and engage both sides of the Congress and have a real consultative relationship. So I do think that things will get through the Congress is required as necessary. I do think there will be other things that they'll have to push through executive order. So we'll see.
Chris, Algie raised something that's important, which is the Senate is split 50-50, which means that Vice President Harris, when she takes the oath of office, is going to have to be spending a lot of time around the Senate to be able to potentially cast tie-breaking votes. Can you give me some sense of how much it matters that it's 50-50 as opposed to 51-49? Does it really change the rhythms of the Senate that much?
It does. It will change a number of things in terms of it's going to be a hard 50-seat majority for Chuck Schumer to manage, because you have moderates on the Democratic side like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema who are going to be hard to bring along on a lot of the Biden agenda items. So you really are going to have some issues there where it really will matter. In terms of the 50-50 split, I think the big question right now is the organizing resolution, which is the resolution by which the Senate decides how committees are staked out, what the memberships are, that kind of thing. And that is still being negotiated by Schumer and McConnell. It remains to be seen exactly what that's going to look like. The last time this happened was 2001, when you had Daschle and Trent Lott. And where they came out was the committees would be divided 50-50. And if something was not able to get through committee, so in other words, you had a strict bipartisan split, nominees and pieces of legislation could then be moved directly to the floor. So I think you may see quite a few times when that occurs where you've got 50-50 splits in the committees and then things go straight to the floor. On the national security side, you have kind of an unusual set of circumstances when it comes to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in that even though it is a 50-50 split, you do have Mitt Romney. So it's possible that Bob Menendez, who's the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, will be able to move things out of his committee. But it does matter in terms of how often Kamala Harris is going to have to be sort of there. I don't know that you're going to see a ton of times where you're going to have a straight 50-50 split, which is the only time the vice president can vote. I think typically you're going to have situations where you know whether you have a 51 vote threshold or a 60 vote threshold with the filibuster. And I think you're going to see the necessity of her being there in things like bringing up Congressional Review Act actions, which is a means by which any rules put in force by the Trump administration after late August of this past year can be rolled back. So I think you're going to see potentially some of those actions. Also on reconciliation, which Algene mentioned, where a lot of the big agenda items of the Biden administration may be able to move, at least the budgetary and tax things may be able to move. And then also in some of the rolling back of the national emergencies that Trump has put in place, which is also a 51 vote threshold. But those are some of the areas where I think, a 50-50 split matters.
Okay, Algene, I want to draw you out on the point you made a little bit earlier about trying to find places for bipartisanship. And I guess I want to really sort of focus in the foreign policy sphere. Where do you see there being opportunities where the Biden administration may be able to get beyond sort of raw partisanship and build something that resembles the bipartisanship of old? Are there particular issues that jump out at you where you say, here's where you have a consensus?
Yeah, I think that there's a real bipartisan consensus that we need to figure out how best to address China and how to combat, China's growing influence in the world. I think that there's recognitions on both sides that China is acting as a competitor at the very minimum, and some people would say adversary, right? But there's a recognition, no matter where you are on that spectrum, that we need to have a real full-throated, comprehensive approach to the way that we challenge China. And I think there's also a recognition that we need to go back when doing this to really work with our traditional allies and engage them in a more comprehensive way as well. I think there's a real strong bipartisan support for engaging NATO. Now, there might be little things here and there about how, the contribution levels and all that stuff, but that we need to engage NATO when it comes to China. I think there's a recognition bipartisan way about Russia as well, on human rights issues, things like that. I think there's a real sense that we need to do more to reestablish our traditional role as, the leader of democratic values and work with our allies and partners to promote those values around the world. And so those are just a few things that I see as really low-hanging fruit, honestly. I think there is definitely bipartisan support for foreign assistance. We've seen the Trump administration over the past 4 years really try to gut the foreign assistance budget, but there's definitely bipartisan support when it comes to the House and Senate passing bills that really support and shore up the foreign assistance budget and the recognition that that's an important part of our national security toolkit. So I do see some synergies there.
And I would agree with Al-Jean on all those things. I would also add Saudi Arabia to the mix.
Oh, yes.
But you've seen in the, you know, over the past 4 years, the Trump administration has tried to do a lot of things, and the appropriators have basically said, no, we're not going to cut foreign assistance. There's definitely a pretty broad consensus among the Democrats and Republicans in Congress on some of the things like a more international approach to the world on part of the United States. So I agree with Al-Jean on all those things.
Well, Kristen, let me ask you the flip side of the question. What are the issues you look at? You say, well, that's where Democrats are going to line up on one side of it and Republicans are going to line up on the other side, and we're going to have sort of a bitter political debate.
I think a lot of the things that the Biden administration is planning to do on the environment, both domestically and globally, are going to get a lot of pushback from Republicans. And that's going to be an enormous part, from what I can tell, is going to be an enormous part of the Biden agenda. And I think you're going to see significant pushback on all those things. And that's going to put guys like Joe Manchin in a very tough spot.
Joe Manchin being the senator from the great state of West Virginia, home to large coal deposits, among other things.
Yes, and went 68% for Donald Trump in the 2020 election. So I think you're going to see things like that. Other areas where there could be some significant partisan friction would be in some of the investigations, I think, that probably are going to come through. You're going to see, I think, even though there will be efforts to sort of move beyond and make the Biden administration the centerpiece, I think there are going to be issues that are going to emerge as Democratic appointees go into these agencies and get a full scope view of everything the Trump administration has done. And there will be significant pressure for them to conduct investigations. And I think that that on the congressional side is going to create quite a bit of partisan friction.
Al-Jean, let me ask you a variant of the question I just asked Chris. As you look at the slate of foreign policy issues that the Biden administration is likely to have to grapple with, are there issues where you say he runs a very real risk that there are going to be important splits within the Democratic Party, that it's going to be very hard for him to knit together? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, off the top of my head, trade is a potential one, but maybe also Iran.
You know, I think trade is definitely one. I think even on some of the climate agenda, there's a split on how far you can go, right? Not everyone supports the Green New Deal on the Democratic side. And I think there have been some attempts, though, to work across the aisle. I think Carper and Barrasso worked out some energy, you know, and climate impacting legislation.
That's a Democrat from Delaware and a Republican from Wyoming?
That's correct.
Okay, so I want to make sure I locate him in the right state.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, worked out some climate impact legislation. And there are some things that we can do that are kind of the bare minimum of how we can work together. And then we can build on that, right? But you're not going to have a Green New Deal coming through the Senate. Okay, that's for sure. But we are going to see, I think, a focus on climate mitigation and other things that maybe people can support, because we're talking about infrastructure and, you know, all of those things. I think other things that people are split on, and we don't know what the Biden administration will do on Cuba. I think that there are Democrats who don't think, very few, but Democrats who don't think we should be as engaged on Cuba, and Republicans who do think we should, you know, so that's something that doesn't necessarily split along party lines, that U.S. posture towards Cuba. I think Iran also is another one where we've had Democrats oppose the nuclear deal, but didn't like the way that the Trump administration pulled out of the deal when Iran was complying. And now they're not at the same state as they were before. So there's going to be, you know, if the administration, the Biden administration incoming, wants to take another look at that, there's going to have to be a real strong consultative process with the Congress moving forward on how and whether and what terms in which they engage with the Iranians and our allies and international community on Iran. I mean, it's certainly a challenge that we need to confront.
Let me ask you about that, LG, because a lot has been made of the fact that Joe Biden spent 6 terms, 36 years in the United States Senate. He is a product of the institution. He has sort of absorbed the byways of the institution. Does his having been in the Senate give him an extra advantage in getting the Senate to follow his lead?
I mean, I think it does. I think he has some relationships across the spectrum. And I think once you get down to it, yeah, I mean, those relationships still stand. We also have, if confirmed, a Secretary of State in Tony Blinken, if confirmed, who has been previously the staff director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And so, you know, there are relationships there. There's respect for the institution, I think, that will foster at least some sort of consultation going forward on the big policies. And I think that that's important to consult. I think in the past administration, there was a lot of frustration on both sides of the aisle, okay, that, you know, there wasn't as much consultation as was warranted. And I, you know, recall working for Senator Ben Cardin and, you know, him being frustrated with the Obama administration at times for some of the things that they did. And Obama had served on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But I think at the end of the day, as long as there is a respect for the institution and a sense that, you know, we need to talk early and often about these issues, give folks a heads up when we're making decisions, and really have a sense of consultation, a stronger push for consultation in the relationship between Congress and the executive branch, I think that that goes a long way.
Chris, can I draw you out on this? Because an awful lot is made about personal connections in the Senate. But I will note that when I look at the Republican side of the aisle in the U.S. Senate today, 75% of Republican senators were elected to the Senate after Joe Biden stepped down to become vice president. So many of the Republicans don't have any tradition of working with Joe Biden as a fellow senator. Does that matter that much? Or is it simply, you know, once you're in the club, that sort of changes a lot of things.
No, I think that matters. And you're seeing not just people who don't necessarily have a relationship with Joe Biden specifically, as opposed to Mitch McConnell, who I think went to church with Joe Biden over the weekend, but it's a different type of member these days. And it's a different type of Congress. And the relationships, I would say, are not as strong as they maybe once were. And people are really concerned about talking to their home states and particularly their bases. And I think that one of the things that's going to be particularly problematic is I think that we on the Republican side have been riding a tiger with the Trump administration for the past, you know, 5 years. And now you're seeing us try to dismount. And we all know that's the hardest part. I think you're also going to see that establishment Democrats like Joe Biden are also riding a tiger of sort of a rising left flank on the Democratic side. And that's going to be hard to dismount or to keep under control, too. You're going to see an administration under enormous pressure from the left, I think, politically, to do a lot of things that are really going to inflame Republicans. And even with personal relationships, point out 75% don't have a personal relationship, but even with the personal relationships, I think that the Biden administration is going to have to walk a very fine line in terms of keeping its left flank happy and being able to work together with Republicans in Congress.
I was thinking, you know, aside from the personal relationships, just the respect for the institution is quite important. And I think the ability and the willingness to really engage in a real substantive way as the administration is making these decisions is really critical. And I think that's what we're going to see a difference. And no, it might not, you know, if there's the personal relationship is not there, it's not the best thing, but the fact that they're being consulted, that relationship building is important. And I think that the fact that so many of the people in the administration, the incoming administration, have done this before, have worked in government, served in these roles before, have worked on the Hill, have a sense of the importance of Congress and why it's important to engage, which I don't think really, and Chris, you tell me if I'm wrong, I don't think I got that sense from the Trump administration that there was a real full respect for the role of Congress.
Absolutely.
And so I think that that's where, aside from the relationship, that's where I think it's going to be key, is that they continuously engage and respect the role of Congress.
Yeah. And we saw some of that during the Obama administration too.
Exactly.
There was not, I think Biden may have more respect for the Congress than previous Democratic administrations.
I agree. On the Russia piece, on the, you know, a lot of pieces, there were times that we were challenging also the Obama administration.
Yeah.
I think it's an important observation, but as a counterweight, I will simply note that history suggests that when people go into the executive branch, they suddenly become very sensitive to the prerogatives of the executive branch and may, in some sense, switch sides. And that goes all the way back to the founding and some of the divisions in the first Washington administration, but I'm not going to do a history lesson. I actually want to close with two things that I think are very important, and I'm hoping you can help me and other people understand where we might be going on them. The first is something we've already mentioned, which is reconciliation, which is a device by which you can move things through the Senate on an expedited basis and you only need 50 votes, no supermajority, that is, it can't be filibustered, but it's only good for things dealing with budgets, money. It can't be used for regulatory things, so you're not going to use it to change auto cafe standards and things like that. So maybe, Chris, you can just sort of tell us from your point of view how reconciliation is likely to play out, because my guess is going to be that Democrats are going to see reconciliation as a way to put their policy blueprint into motion, and Republicans are going to scream foul and say, you're denying us the opportunity to participate. How's it all going to play out?
Yeah, there will be two bites at the apple this year because you've got a budget. So reconciliation is passed as part of the passage of the annual budget resolution. And my understanding is that you've got both the 2021 budget resolution that never went through and then the 2022.
Correct. Two bites at the apple this time.
Yeah, two bites at the apple. And with such a narrowly divided Senate, you are going to see quite a bit of things moving as part of the reconciliation process. I think a lot of these are going to be largely domestic. So you're going to see probably a big move to put some climate funds into reconciliation. Now, even though you do have problems with sort of Democratic moderates, you also have Republican moderates who may be willing, like a Susan Collins, for example, to vote in favor of those kinds of things. So, you know, reconciliation when it comes to issues like tax and some of the things that essentially rolling back some of the things that the Trump administration did on tax changes and tax reductions. I think that is going to be something that will be part of reconciliation in one of the two packages. But I think they're going to plan to move a significant chunk of their agenda as much as they can. And this is subject to a number of different arcane rules. There are actually six sort of sub-rules of what they call the Byrd Rule. You can look that up if you want.
B-Y-R-D after Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia.
That's correct. That's right. And in the mid-80s, he actually, and this is all based on what the parliamentarian rules is, can be part of a reconciliation package, but it's based on the Byrd Rule. So you will see a lot of things that they may try and put into reconciliation that are then subjected to what they call a Byrd bath, and they're not allowed to put these things into the reconciliation package. But I think this is going to be the train that's leaving the station, or one of the two trains that's leaving the station as far as the Biden agenda is concerned.
And I should note, just for the record, reconciliation has been used in the past. Trump administration used it, I believe. The George W. Bush administration famously used it for its tax cut package back in 2001. So it's not something that Democrats have invented. Algene, I want to close by asking you about something related to reconciliation, which is the filibuster. One of the reasons people like reconciliation when they're in the majority is it allows you to get around the Senate filibuster, at least on a set of issues dealing with budgetary matters. But the filibuster rule remains, and there's been a lot of talk about whether the Democrats should get rid of the filibuster. My sense is that's not going to happen right away, but it may happen down the road. Can you sort of walk us through what the thinking is among Democrats about the filibuster and whether it's a good idea to get rid of it or a really bad idea?
I think that, you know, before the election in November, there was pressure mounting on the left to eliminate the filibuster. And, you know, I think Republicans charged that Democrats wanted to, you know, pack the Supreme Court or give statehood to Democratic strongholds, such as, you know, the District of Columbia. And that's why they wanted to do that. But I know that moderate Democrat Joe Manchin, again, of West Virginia, says he'll block any attempt to eliminate the filibuster. So I don't think that for now that we'll see that happen. And I personally, just as speaking as a private citizen, I think this filibuster is what makes the Senate the Senate, right? The ability of any one member to stand up and have the same rights, no matter how junior or senior you are, to challenge a piece of legislation. I think it's really important. It's what makes the Senate the Senate. It's what makes us all have to work together. I would say us, me and Chris in our past lives, having to work together, forcing the issue of us working across the aisle to make sure that we get towards common sense legislation. It's what makes the Senate the Senate. So I would hope that they, you know, don't do that. And I think, though, that it's important that we do have a sense of bipartisanship as we move forward, and a sense for respecting the rights of the minority and the majority as we move forward. I think that there's a lot that can be done without eliminating the filibuster.
And I would just say that eliminating the filibuster is short-term gain for long-term pain. And it always is going to come back and bite you in the end, I think. And you see that with some of the Trump nominations that were able to move because the original, you know, back when Harry Reid diminished the threshold, used the nuclear option, that led the way.
This is for judicial nominees.
For judicial nominees. That led the way for things like Supreme Court justices being able to move with a mere 51-vote threshold. So.
Yes. And can I speak really quickly to reconciliation? I want to point out a couple of things that I think that the administration could use reconciliation for. And I think, you know, there's going to be a push for more stimulus money for COVID. I think there's going to be a push for new spending on vaccines, maybe more virus testing, state and local aid related to COVID, schools and childcare aid. All of those could be things that they push for, again, almost exclusively on the domestic side, but we will see that. But they're not going to be able to do things like create a COVID protection standard for frontline workers, health workers, right? Through reconciliation, because that doesn't meet the budget threshold and doesn't have
it's a non-budgetary topic. So it's
exactly
out of order.
Right. So, but there, I think there's, you know, maybe rental assistance could be considered part of that, but nothing that doesn't, if something doesn't touch the budget and doesn't require spending, you can't do it under reconciliation. So we'll see some stuff, I think, go through that hopefully can help Americans who are impacted by this virus and the economic downturn due to that really get over this hump until we can get everyone vaccinated. And hopefully that's soon.
I suspect that a lot of journalists will be writing a lot of articles trying to explain the arcane rules of reconciliation to the American public, which is going to be baffled by some of this terminology. But on that point, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Algene Sagerig, who is the CEO of Catalyst Global Strategies and the host of the podcast, The Minority Leaders, and Chris Tuttle, who is a Managing Director here at CFR. Algene and Chris, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with Senior Producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.